Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 29, More Home Cooking Myths Exposed. Hey everybody, welcome again and thank you for downloading and listening to this episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. I'm Roger, your host, and today we've got a fun one planned for you. You know, back in November of 2014, I think it was, one of my earlier episodes, which actually turned out to be one of my most popular episodes, was a cooking myth list that I had done. I called it Seven Home Cooking Myths Exposed, and it's gone on to be my most popular episode. So tonight I thought I would record a sequel. So I've come back with a whole new list of cooking myths to cover. But before I get to that, I want to mention a couple of quick things. What I've been up to lately and a request from you, dear listener. So first of all, I want to mention that I was a guest on the Podcast Without Borders show this week for their episode number 12. So Podcast Without Borders is a couple of fine Canadian gentlemen, Aaron and Dave, and their show is all about interviewing other podcasters and just kind of finding out what makes them tick and have a fun conversation. So I was on that show this week. So if you want to check it out, you can head over to podcastwithoutborders.com. And like I said, I am in episode number 12. So take a look at that. And if you do, tell Aaron and Dave I sent you over there. And the other thing I want to mention before I get into the main content of the show, next week, I think I'm going to do a question and answer show. And actually, we did a little bit of this on the Podcast Without Borders segments, but I thought it might be fun if I did my own show completely full of questions from listeners. So if you have a question for me on recipes or food or home cooking or the show, the podcast, me, whatever, and you'd like me to answer it on the show next week, go ahead and send those in to me. You can email me at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com, or of course you can also find me on Twitter at TKC Podcast, or you can post it in the Facebook page at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast. All right, that's it for the housekeeping in this episode. Let's get right into the show. Right, so I mentioned way back in episode 9 of the Kitchen Counter Podcast, I had done a seven home cooking myths exposed list, and it was a lot of fun. And what I'd done is I took seven I thought were frequently heard by me, or more interesting ones, or common cooking myths or misconceptions about food, and I kind of went through the list. But instead of just listing out myths and saying why they were myths, I did something a little different, and I'm going to do it again this time. I kind of turned it into a bit of a game. So I tweaked some of these myths, the statements, so they are going to become true or false statements. So I think it would be fun if you played along, and I'd love to know how you do. So I'm going to read a statement, or I might give you a scenario, and I'm going to ask if it's true or false, if it's in essence a myth or not, what I'm saying. And then I have these fun little sounds I'm going to play. So after I read it out and give you a couple of seconds to think about it, if it's true, you'll hear this. Isn't that a pleasant, positive sound? And then if it's false, you'll hear this. Yeah, your classic buzzer sound. So grab a piece of paper, unless you're driving, or if you're carpooling, have somebody else keep score. But follow along, let me know how you do, and I have no prizes if you get them all right, just my undying admiration for humoring me with my little game here. So now some of these myths, if you will, are probably easily debunked. You've probably heard about them forever and know they're not true. And some of them might be more difficult. I don't know. I picked a range. You know, I have a whole huge long list of these things. So I just kind of went through and I picked seven more to go through. So we'll see. We'll see how we do. So let's start out with the first one here. So, oh, and by the way, if you've listened to my shows in the past, a couple of these I've kind of covered. So you might already have good clues from that. All right, here we go. Number one, you should put your hot leftovers in the fridge as soon as possible. That is, you should put them in the fridge before you let them cool down. All right. So I know this is a controversial one, and I know people go back and forth on the right thing to do here, but I want to know if this is a true or false statement that you should put your hot leftovers in the refrigerator as soon as you can before you let them cool down. Okay. What do you think? Are you ready? Okay. Here we go. It is. That's right. It's true. That's true. You should be putting your food, your leftovers, if you're planning on keeping them for food safety purposes, you should be putting them in your refrigerator as soon as you can. Way back in an earlier episode on food safety, I talked about the danger zone with food, with cooked food. So anytime you have food that's between 40 degrees Fahrenheit and 140 degrees Fahrenheit, that's kind of known as the danger zone. That's the temperature range where bacteria can multiply and cause your food to be unsafe. Now, some folks will say if you put hot food into a refrigerator, you're going to heat the food around it up, causing an unsafe condition, and you're going to make your fridge work a little bit harder to cool that food down. Well, that's true to a degree, but the rule of thumb with having food between that 40 and 140 danger zone is not just that it's in that temperature range, but it's how long it sits in that temperature range. So it's much better to get your food in the fridge where it can cool down to a safe temperature much more quickly. And the fact that you might be heating up food a little bit around it, it's not going to matter all that much because the food's not going to stay very warm for very long. And by the way, when you're storing leftovers, if you've got, let's say, a giant bowl of hot soup, it's better to break that down into smaller containers to put in the fridge instead of like one big super hot bowl they put in the fridge, because it'll cool down a lot quicker in the smaller batches that you save it in. All right, so that was number one. That was true. You should put your hot leftovers in the fridge right away. All right, let's go on to the second one. Okay, now it was Cinco de Mayo yesterday, at least as I record this, maybe not as you listen, but I have an avocado question for you, more specifically a guacamole question or statement. So when making guacamole, if you put your avocado pit into the guacamole, it will prevent it from turning brown. So what do you think about that one? Putting avocado pits in your guacamole will prevent the guacamole from turning brown. What do you think about that one? I'm sure we've all heard this one, and some of us may even do it, but is it a myth or not? All right, ready? Here we go. Yep, that's a myth. So putting avocado pits in your guacamole technically don't keep the guacamole from turning brown. And here's what happens. Avocados have the same type of enzymes as bananas and apples that cause it to turn brown. So, you know, when you cut open an apple, or if you even look at a banana wrong, you know, you barely tap it, it'll start turning brown. When these enzymes come into contact with oxygen, it causes an oxidation, almost like a rust, if you will, in the fruit. So avocado has the exact same enzyme as these bananas and apples. So when you crush up an avocado to make guacamole, of course, you're breaking down the cell walls. You're exposing these enzymes to oxygen. So when you do put a pit in your guacamole, you'll probably notice that the guacamole underneath the pit will actually not turn brown. And that's not because there's some magical property to the avocado pit that's preventing it from doing that. It's just that the avocado pit is preventing oxygen from reaching that guacamole. Unfortunately, all the guacamole around the avocado pit would still turn brown eventually. So your best bet, if you make guacamole and you're not eating it right away, which I can't imagine you wouldn't, but if you want to save it and you don't want it to turn brown, there's a couple of things you could try. One, you could put your guacamole in a bowl and then take saran wrap or plastic wrap and press it, you know, cover it, and then press the saran wrap down so it's actually touching the top of your guacamole to minimize how much oxygen is actually touching it. That'll help a bit. An even more interesting thing you could try is putting your guacamole in a bowl and then pouring a really thin layer of oil, like olive oil, over the top of your guacamole to create basically an oxygen barrier with the oil. You could throw that in your fridge and eat your guacamole later that day or maybe even the next day, and you probably won't have brown guacamole. So avocado pits, don't stop it from turning brown. It's all about oxygen and keeping it off of your guacamole. Okay, let's go on to the third one. All right, this is an extremely common one. I have heard this one forever. I know a ton of people that do it. But the question is whether it's actually effective or not. So here is number three. Adding oil to your pasta cooking water will prevent the pasta from sticking together. So is that true? If you put a bit of oil into the water that you cook your pasta in, it will prevent the pasta from sticking together. What do you think about that one? Is that a myth or not? All right, ready? Here we go. Yep, that is a myth. Oil in your pasta water will not do anything to keep your pasta from sticking together. First of all, oil and water don't necessarily mix too well, especially in pasta cooking water. So even if you put oil in there, it's probably not going to be coating the pasta as it's cooking. Now, some folks might say that once you drain your pasta, you should throw a little oil on the pasta at that time and toss it, and it will keep the pasta from sticking together, which is absolutely true. However, if you're planning on saucing that pasta, that oil will also prevent pasta from sticking to it. You're going to get rid of all the, you're going to coat all the nice starches that have built up on that pasta. So that's probably not a great idea either. So I think the number one culprit for pasta sticking together is when you drain it and you just let it sit and it kind of congeals and sticks together. That's the problem. So what you want to do, in my opinion, is get that pasta back in a pot and put a little bit of sauce on it at least and toss it together. That sauce will coat the pasta enough that it's not going to stick together. So that is a myth. Adding oil to your pasta water does nothing to prevent the pasta from sticking together. Okay? All right, on to number four. Now this is an interesting one. Maybe this one's not exactly a myth or not, but it's definitely could fall into the old cook's tale category, depending on if it's true or not. So let's talk about mustard. And if you've ever made your own mustard, you'll know that you take mustard seed or already ground mustard seed and add water to it to make mustard. Now, let's say you want to make really hot, spicy mustard. In that case, you'll want to use the coldest water you can use, because when you use cold water to mix mustard, the hotter the finished mustard will be. So what do you think about that? Using cold water makes mustard hotter. What do you think? Is that a myth or is that true? All right, here we go. Are you ready? You got your answer written down? Yep, that's right. It's one of the strangest things I've ever heard, but it's absolutely true. So mustard typically comes in three varieties, at least the kind that we would make mustard out of. One is kind of like white mustard seed. There's a brown mustard seed, and then there's a black mustard seed. Now, the lighter to darker is generally milder to spicier. However, in any of those three varieties, when you crush the mustard seed or you take the mustard powder and you mix in water, the water causes a chemical reaction with some enzymes that are in that mustard seed. Now, what's interesting is hot water, the hotter the water, actually denatures some of those enzymes and will make a more mild mustard. Incidentally, vinegar also will make a more mild mustard. So if you add vinegar in to your mustard mixture, it will kick down the heat. But generally, when all things are equal, the hotter the water, the milder the mustard. So if you want a really spicy mustard, or the spiciest you can get with any particular variety of seed you're using, you want to use really cold water. And to me, that's one of those that almost sounds like, obviously, a total urban legend or a myth, that the temperature of water that you would mix something up with would affect its overall spiciness. But that's the way it is. All right, we're down with four, and we've got three left to go. So how are you doing so far? Are we 100%? Are these way too easy? Are they totally cruddy questions? I don't know. You tell me. So let's move on to the next one. Now, this one isn't a cooking question per se, but it does have to do with food. So what if I told you that nutritionally, there's absolutely no difference between organic and conventionally raised produce? So what I'm saying there is, for example, an organic Granny Smith apple is nutritionally identical to a conventionally raised Granny Smith apple. Is that true or is that false? What do you think about that? Well, here is the answer. That's right. That's right. Organic and conventionally raised produce, equal food items, are nutritionally equal. Now, there may be reasons why you prefer organic, and maybe that's because you like the way the farming is done, you know, using fewer synthetic pesticides, those sorts of things. But it's important to remember that organic certification is an agricultural certification. It has nothing to do with the nutritional value of your food. So whether it's organic lettuce or conventional lettuce, whether they're organic strawberries or conventional strawberries, all the way down the line, nutritionally, calorie-wise, vitamin-wise, they're going to be pretty much identical between organic and conventional. So keep that in mind. All right, we've got a couple more to go here. So to recap, we've done five, and we have two more to go. And I don't know if these are tricky or not, but let's go on. So let's say you make a really great soup. It's one of your favorite soup recipes, and you whip this up, and you go to taste it, and to your horror, you realized you added twice, or let's say three times as much salt as you should have. So your soup is ridiculously salty, almost inedible, and you're freaking out. And you've heard that if you take some peeled raw potatoes and you drop those into the soup and you cook it for a little while, that those potatoes will actually extract salt out of that soup and make it less salty. So do you think that's true, or do you think that's a myth? So if you take a potato and you put it into an overly salty soup or a stew and you cook it for a while, your soup or stew will be less salty. What do you think? All right, here we go. Here's the answer. That's right. It's not true, unfortunately. This is a pretty widespread belief. And on the surface of things, it kind of makes sense, because the idea that you would be adding food to your soup, for example, you would think maybe would make it less salty. And in reality, the potato does actually draw in some salt from the surrounding liquid. The problem is it also draws in some surrounding liquid. So you're not really taking salt out. You're taking a little bit of salt out and a little bit of liquid out and getting it in that potato. So the ratio really doesn't change. You're still going to end up with almost inedible soup in that scenario. So your best bet, if you ever make something that's too salty, that's almost inedible, especially if it's a soup or something like that, is you want to increase the ratio of liquid to salt. So maybe you need to add another cup of water, for example, to dilute that salt in that particular soup, or some more milk, or whatever it is that's the base of your soup. But putting potatoes into your soup to make it less salty, that just won't work, unfortunately. You'll end up with salty, potato-y soup. So we're down to our last item in our list of seven cooking myths. And let's see if this one is true or false, and then let's see how you did on the score, and I'll recap all the answers. So number seven, chicken eggs. If you're unsure if the chicken eggs that you have in your refrigerator are safe to eat or not, you can do a simple test. You can float the eggs in cold water. If the eggs float to the top of the water, they're not safe to eat. How does that sound? Does that sound reasonable? If you take eggs and you float them in cold water, and the eggs actually float to the top as opposed to like sinking to the bottom of the bowl, if they float to the top, they're not safe to eat. What do you think about that? All right. Here is the answer. Yep, that's actually true. So that is a test you can do with your eggs at home. And there's generally three outcomes to this test. So if you have an egg or eggs, and you pop an egg in a bowl of nice cold water, three things are probably going to happen. It's either going to lay down flat, kind of on its side in the bottom of the bowl. If it does that, it means your egg is pretty dang fresh, pretty darn fresh egg. It's going to be great for pretty much anything you want to do to it. If the egg kind of doesn't lay flat, but kind of tilts up on its end, so like that kind of the wider, fatter end of the egg kind of sticks up in the air, that means your egg isn't really, really fresh. It's still perfectly edible, But it's just, it's not going to be quite as snappy and fresh. And maybe it's better for boiling, for example, to make boiled eggs. But again, still perfectly edible for pretty much whatever you want to do. If the egg floats, don't eat it. It's just probably not good anymore. And the reason behind this is when an egg, when a chicken lays an egg, there's a small pocket of air in that fat end. You know, an egg is kind of oblong with kind of a skinny and a fat end. That fat end of the egg has a little air pocket in it, which is quite small after the egg is laid, but it grows over time as because eggshells are porous and the eggs absorb, you know, more air and gas. So that as that pocket becomes larger, it actually makes the egg more buoyant. And that's why when it gets a little bit larger, it raises that end of the egg up in the water so it kind of sits on its end. But when an egg starts floating, there's so much of it in there, your egg is probably turned. And yeah, you don't want to eat it. And by the way, I should also mention, this is another fact about eggs. So when you go to buy eggs in the store and, you know, you buy a dozen eggs in the carton or whatever, and there's usually a date stamped on the end of the package, like the best buy date. It's good to keep in mind that that date isn't actually an expiration date for eggs. That really just means like a best quality buy. If your eggs go over that date by a few days or a week, they're probably still perfectly fine to eat. You know, maybe you want to boil them or maybe you want to use them in baking. But if you're really unsure, if they're really way past the date, you can try the egg float test to know for sure. All right. Well, that was seven new true or false cooking statements. I won't call them cooking myths outright, but I'm curious to know how you did. So let me just run right back through the list and we'll recap your answers. So number one was true, that you should put your leftovers in the fridge as soon as you can. You shouldn't necessarily let them cool down before you put them away. Number two was false. Putting avocado pits in your guacamole will not prevent the guacamole from turning brown. Well, it will, but just the little spot that's under the pit itself. Number three, adding oil to your pasta water will prevent pasta from sticking together. That's false. That just doesn't work. Remember, get your pasta out and drained and sauced up as soon as you can, and that's the best way to prevent it from sticking. Number four, this was the mustard question. So if you're mixing your own mustard, the colder the water you use, the hotter your mustard will end up being. And conversely, the hotter the water you use, the more mild your mustard. So that was true. When mixing your own mustard, the colder the water, the hotter the mustard. All right, number five. There is no difference in the nutritional value between organic and conventional produce. That was true. There might be differences in other ways, like level of pesticide residue or the way they were actually raised. But as far as nutrition, they're pretty much the same thing. Number six, adding potato to oversalted soups or stews will make them less salty. That was false. That doesn't work, unfortunately. The only way you're going to make something less salty is to dilute the salt with probably more liquid. And lastly, we had the chicken egg float test, and that chicken eggs that float in water are probably bad and you shouldn't eat them. They're unsafe to eat. That's true. Okay, so I'd love to know if you played along and how you did. So, of course, for fun, let me know and hit me up on Twitter at TKC Podcast, Facebook.com/KitchenCounterPodcast, or shoot me an email at feedback@KitchenCounterPodcast.com. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. This is where I'm going to wrap up today. This was a little bit different episode. I hope you had fun with it. As I mentioned, I've got a bunch more of these, so maybe a little ways down the road, I'll do another one of these types of episodes. And by the way, if you've got an urban legend or an old cook's tale or a cooking myth you want me to talk about on that future episode down the road, let me know and I will add it to the list. You know, I want to say also, if this was your first episode and you just found me, I want to thank you so much for listening this far into the show and giving me a shot. I hope you enjoyed it. Let me know. And if you listen to me regularly on iTunes or Stitcher or Player FM or TuneIn Radio, I'd love it if you would head over there if you haven't already and leave a review for the show or tell your friends about it. It really helps people discover us here at the Kitchen Counter Podcast. So that's all I've got for you today. Thanks again. I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to listen. So until next time, I am Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.